Chapter 51. 7 o'clock in the morning. A blue sky, unlimited visibility, and a sea with low swells rolling like silent demons toward unseen shores where they would crash and die. It was a normal day, like most days in the tropical waters off the Hawaiian Islands, warm with more than a trace of humidity and a light breeze, generally referred to as the trade winds. It was a Saturday, a day when the beaches at Waikiki and the windward side of the island were slowly coming alive with early birds awake for an early morning dip. Soon they would be followed by thousands of local residents and vacationers looking forward to leisurely hours of swimming in surf subdued by offshore reefs, and sunbathing on heated sand later in the day. Lulled by the relaxing atmosphere, none were remotely aware that this might be their last day on Earth. The Glomar Explorer, only one of her big twin screws driving under full power, pushed steadily toward the site of the deadly acoustic convergence, sound waves already hurtling through the sea from the four sources. She should have been running a good half hour late, but Chief Engineer Toft had pushed his crew to and beyond the edge of exhaustion. He cursed and pleaded with the engine that strained against its mounts, bound to the only operating shaft, and coaxed another half-knot out of it. He swore to get the ship to its meeting with destiny with time to spare, and by God he was doing it. Up on the starboard wing of the bridge, Sandecker peered through binoculars at a commercial version of the Navy's SH-60B Seahawk helicopter, with Pneuma markings, as it approached the ship from bow on, circled once and dropped onto the big ship's stern landing pad. Two men hurried from the aircraft and entered the aft superstructure. A minute later, they joined Sandecker on the bridge. "Did the drop go well?" Sandecker asked anxiously. Dr. Sanford Adgate Ames nodded with a slight smile. "Four arrays of remote acoustical sensing instruments have been deployed under the surface at the required locations 30 kilometers distant from the convergence zone. We laid them directly in the four estimated paths of the sound channels," added Gunn, who had made the flight with Ames. "They're set to measure the final approach and intensity of the sound?" Sandecker asked. Ames nodded. "The telemetry data from the underwater modems will be relayed by their surface flotation satellite link to the onboard processor and analyst terminal here on board the Explorer. The system works similarly to submarine acoustic locating programs. Fortunately, we have a weather and current window working in our favor," said Gunn. "All things considered, the sound waves should come together as predicted." "Warning time?" "Sound travels underwater at an average of 1,500 meters per second," replied Ames. "I figure 20 seconds from when the sound waves pass the modems until they strike the reflector dish under the ship."
20 seconds," Sandecker repeated. "Damn little time to mentally prepare for the unknown."
"Since no one without some kind of protection has survived to describe the full intensity of the convergence, my best estimate of its duration before it is totally deflected toward Gladiator Island is approximately 4.5 minutes. Anyone on board the ship who does not reach the dampened shelter will surely die horribly." Sandecker turned and gestured at the vivid green mountains of Oahu, only 15 kilometers distant. "Will any effects reach the people on shore?" "They might feel a brief but sharp pain inside their heads, but no permanent harm should come to them." Sandecker stared out the bridge windows at the huge mass of machinery soaring skyward in the middle of the ship. Infinite miles of cable and hydraulic lines ranged over the deck from the derrick and cranes. Teams of men and women, sitting and standing on platforms suspended in the air like those used by skyscraper window cleaners, worked at reconnecting the seemingly unending number of links on the enormous reflector shield. The giant derrick held the main frame of the shield, while the surrounding cranes lifted the smaller numbered pieces into their slots where they were then joined. Thanks to Rudy Gunn's foresight in cleaning and oiling the connectors, all parts fit quickly and smoothly. The operation was going like clockwork. Only two more parts were left to install. The Admiral turned his gaze toward the jewel of the Pacific, easily distinguishing details of Diamond Head, the hotel strung along Waikiki Beach, the Aloha Tower in Honolulu,
the homes fading into the clouds that always seemed to hover over Mount Tantalus, the jetliners landing at the International Airport, the facilities at Pearl Harbor. There could be no room for error. Unless the operation went according to plan, the beautiful island would become a vast killing field. At last he looked at the man studying the digital numbers on the ship's computerized navigation system. "Captain Quick?" The master of the Glomar Explorer looked up. "Admiral Sandecker?" "How far to the site?" Quick smiled. It was only the 20th time the Admiral had asked the same question since departing Halava Bay. "Less than 500 meters and another 20 minutes until we begin pinpointing the ship over the numbers your people computed for the global positioning system."
"Which leaves us only 40 minutes to deploy the reflector shield. Thanks to Chief Toft and his engine room crew, otherwise we never could have made it on schedule."
"Yes," Sandecker agreed, "we owe him big." The long minutes passed with everyone in the wheelhouse keeping one eye on the clock and the other on the red digital numbers of the global positioning system as they diminished finally to a row of zeros, indicating the ship was over the precise site where the sound rays were calculated to converge and explode with unparalleled intensity. The next project was to hold the ship in the exact spot. Captain Quick focused on programming the coordinates into the automated ship's control system, which analyzed sea and weather conditions and controlled the thruster jets on the bow and stern. In an incredibly short time span, the Glomar Explorer had achieved station and was able to hover motionless in the water, resisting wind and current within a deviation factor of less than a meter. Several other systems, each critical to the operation, also came into play. The pitch was feverish. Teams of engineers and technicians, electronic systems experts and scientists worked simultaneously to put the reflector shield in the precise path of the sound waves. The NUMA team, working on platforms far above the deck, made the final connections and attached the shield to the drop hook of the derrick. Far below, one of the most unique sections of the ship stirred to life. Taking up the middle third of the ship, the 1,367-square-meter moon pool, as it was called, filled with water as two sections of the center hull, one fore, the other aft, retracted into specially designed sleeves. The true heart of the seafloor dredging system and what had been the recovery operation of the Russian submarine, the moon pool was where it all came together, where the dredging hose would be extended thousands of meters deep to the minerals carpeting the ocean's bottom, and where the vast reflector shield would be lowered into the sea. The engineering systems on board the Glomar Explorer were originally constructed to raise heavy objects from the seafloor, not to lower lighter but more expansive objects downward. Procedures were hurriedly modified for the complex operation. Minor glitches were quickly overcome. Every move was coordinated and performed with precision. The tension on the lowering cable was increased by the derrick operator until the reflector hung free in the air. The appropriate signal by the NUMA team was given, indicating that the reflector assembly was all completed. The entire unit was then lowered diagonally through the rectangular moon pool into the sea with centimeters to spare. It was that close. The immersion time ran 10 meters a minute. Full deployment by the cables securing the dish at the precise angle and depth to ricochet the sound waves to Gladiator Island took 14 minutes. 6 minutes and 10 seconds to convergence, Captain Quick's voice droned over the ship's loudspeakers. All ship's personnel will go to the engine room storage compartment at the aft end of the ship and enter as you have been instructed. Do this immediately. I say immediately. Run, do not walk. Suddenly, everyone was dropping down ladders and scaffolding, hurrying in unison like a pack of marathon runners toward the propulsion and pump room deep in the bowels of the ship. Here, 20 ship's crew members had been busily sound-isolating the supply compartment with every piece of dampening material they could lay their hands on. The ship's towels, blankets, bedding, and mattresses, along with all cushions from lounge chairs and any scraps of lumber they could scrounge, were placed against ceiling, deck, and bulkheads to deaden all intruding sound. As they rushed down the passageways below decks, Sandecker said to Ames, "This is the agonizing part of the operation."
"I know what you're thinking," Ames replied, agilely descending two steps at a time. "The anxiety of wondering if we made a tiny miscalculation that put us in the wrong place at the wrong time. The frustration of not knowing whether we succeeded if we don't live through the convergence. The unknown factors are mind-boggling."
They reached the engine room storage compartment, which had been selected to ride out the convergence because of its watertight door and its total lack of air ducts. They were checked in by two ship's officers who were counting heads and handing out sound-deadening headgear that fit over the ears.
"Admiral Sandecker, Dr. Ames, please place these over your ears and try not to move around."
Sandecker and Ames found the Pneuma team members settled in one corner of the compartment and joined them, moving beside Rudy Gunn and Molly Faraday, who had preceded them. They immediately gathered around monitoring systems that were integrated with the warning modems and other underwater sensors. Only the Admiral, Ames, and Gunn held off using the sound deadeners so they could confer right up to the final few seconds. The compartment quickly filled amid a strange silence. Unable to hear, no one spoke. Captain Quick stood on a small box so he could be observed by all in the room. He held up two fingers as a two-minute warning. The derrick operator, who had the farthest to travel, was the last man to enter. Satisfied that every person on the ship had been accounted for, the captain ordered that the door be sealed. Several mattresses were also pressed against the exit to muffle any sound that seeped into the confined compartment. Quick held up one finger, and the tension began to build until it lay like a mantle over the people packed closely together. All stood. There wasn't enough room to sit or recline. Gunn had calculated that the 96 men and women had less than 15 minutes in the tight quarters before their breathable air stagnated and they were overwhelmed by the effects of asphyxiation. Already the atmosphere was beginning to grow stale. The only other immediate danger was claustrophobia rearing its ugly head. The last thing they needed was unbridled hysteria. He gave Molly an encouraging wink and began monitoring the time while almost everyone else watched the ship's captain, as if he were a symphony orchestra conductor with poised baton. Quick raised both hands and curled them into fists. The moment of truth had arrived. Everything now hinged on the data analyzed by Hiram Yeager's computer network. The ship was on station exactly as directed. The shield was in the precise position calculated by Yeager and cross-checked by Dr. Ames and his staff. The entire operation, down to the slightest detail, was acted upon. Nothing less than a sudden and unusual change in sea temperature, or an unforeseen seismic occurrence that significantly altered the ocean's current, could spell disaster. The enormous consequences of failure were blanked from the minds of the Pneuma team. 5 seconds passed, then 10. Sandecker began to feel the prickle of disaster in the nape of his neck. Then suddenly, ominously, the acoustic sensors, 30 kilometers distant, began registering the incoming sound waves along their predicted paths.
"Good Lord," muttered Ames. "The sensors have gone off the scale. The intensity is greater than I estimated."
20 seconds and counting, snapped Sandecker. "Get your ear mufflers on." The first indication of the convergence was a small resonance that rapidly grew in magnitude. The dampened bulkheads vibrated in conjunction with a hum that penetrated the sound-deadening ear protectors. The crowded people in the confined room sensed a mild form of disorientation and vertigo. But no one was struck by nausea, and none panicked. The discomfort was borne stoically. Sandecker and Ames stared at each other, fulfillment swamping them in great trembling waves. 5 long minutes later, it was all over. The resonance had faded away, leaving an almost supernatural silence behind it. Gunn was the first to react. He tore off his sound deadeners, waved his arms, and shouted at Captain Quick. "The door! Open the door and let some air in here!" Quick got the message. The mattresses were cast aside and the door undogged and thrown open. The air that filtered into the room reeked with oil from the ship's engine room,
but was welcomed by all as they slowly removed the sound deadeners from their heads. Vastly relieved the threat was over, they shouted and laughed like fans celebrating a win of their favorite football team. Then slowly, in an orderly manner, they filed from the storage room, up the companionways and into the fresh air. Sandecker's reaction time was almost inhuman. He ran up the companionways to the wheelhouse in a time that would have broken any existing record if there had been one. He snatched up a pair of binoculars and rushed out onto the bridge wing. Anxiously, he focused the lenses on the island, only 15 kilometers distant. Cars were traveling routinely on the streets, and busy crowds of sunseekers moved freely about the beaches. Only then did he expel a long sigh and sag in relief over the railing, totally drained of emotion. "An utter triumph, Admiral," Ames said, pumping Sandecker's hand. "You proved the best scientific minds in the country wrong." "I was blessed with your expertise and support, Doc," Sandecker said, as if a great weight had been lifted from his shoulders. "I'd have accomplished nothing but for you and your staff of bright young scientists." Overcome with exhilaration, Gunn and Molly both hugged Sandecker, an act considered unthinkable on any other occasion. "You did it," said Gunn. "Nearly 2 million lives saved, thanks to your stubbornness." "We did it," Sandecker corrected him. "From beginning to end, it was a team effort." Gunn's expression suddenly turned sober. "A great pity Dirk wasn't here to see it." Sandecker nodded solemnly. "His concept was the spark that ignited the project." Ames studied the array of instruments he had set up during the voyage from Molokai. "The reflector positioning was perfect," he said happily. "The acoustic energy was reversed exactly as intended." "Where is it now?" asked Molly. "Combined with the energy from the other 3 island mining operations, the sound waves are traveling back to Gladiator Island faster than any jet plane. Their combined force should strike the submerged base in roughly 97 minutes. "I'd love to see his face." "Whose face?" asked Ames innocently. "Arthur Dorset's," answered Molly, "when his private island starts to rock and roll."